time for us to end this hierarchy of who has the right to live, who deserves not to suffer.
As an indigenous person, the fur trade represents so much more to me than just animal abuse. It represents cultural genocide.
Status police summarized, there were 6 or 8 in the raiding party.
Who would not know about terrible...
These kinds of actions are going to be more and more frequent.
Every laboratory raiding comes from information from inside the lab, from someone who works there, who's just hearing the animals scream.
They found the animals crippled and helpless, unable to use their arms and legs. No food or medical care. Broken bones, fingers and toes torn off.
14 of the 2 dozen protesters were blocking the entrance of
the... Their private receptionists say the animals have been taken to an undisclosed location out of state.
The U.S. Department is alone with the truth, but our government is operating concentration camps for animals.
Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. My first thought today when I got up this morning was, this is the first Animal Voices under a conservative government.
Disgusting.
I mean,
that's
really
the peanut gallery over here. It will be interesting.
That's Lamia pecking. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. Definitely various different political views. I would have loved to hear Rob. He's originally from Alberta. He's our co-host of Animal Voices. He isn't here today, but I think it will be interesting.
To say the least.
I mean, maybe something very positive will come out of it. Anyway, it'll be interesting, too, to see if any kind of animal issues can be brought forward to the NDP, if they'll be willing to move on anything as well. So we'll see.
I haven't totally followed... since I woke up this morning, haven't totally followed. Did the NDP get more seats? That's great.
I think 29.
Wow, cool, yay.
Yeah, so I was up way too late last night watching all of the stuff. But regardless, I hope that you did vote. It was good to see that more people went out and participated. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. I guess I should tell you that. We have a really exciting show today. I think it's an interesting juxtaposition with our current political system right now. I wonder if Keith will have anything to say. We're speaking with the co-founder of the organization Food Not Bombs, and I'm really excited to speak with Keith. I'll read you a little bit about Food Not Bombs. He'll fill us more in on the movement, but it's really quite incredible. So this is from the Food Not Bombs website. There are hundreds of autonomous chapters sharing free vegetarian food with hungry people and protesting war and poverty. This energetic grassroots movement is active through the Americas, Europe, Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Australia. Food Not Bombs is organizing for peace and an end to the occupations of Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. For over 25 years, the movement has worked to end hunger and has supported actions to stop the globalization of the economy, restrictions to the movements of people, and exploitation and the destruction of the earth. And today we are honored to be joined live by Keith McHenry, one of the original co-founders of Food Not Bombs. We're going to hear how McHenry has fed people, protested against state repression and environmental destruction, faced police brutality, served time, and managed to keep going after decades of unrelenting activism. Inspired by books like Diet for a Small Planet, vegetarianism has always been integral to the revolutionary vision of Food Not Bombs. On this week's program, we get a primer on the history of the nonviolent movement and find out how you can be involved. And we're going to peek into the personal life of this really extraordinary activist whose battle scars and laugh lines chart a fascinating journey through a landscape of social and political change. It's always fascinating to speak with somebody who's been involved for so long and who's managed not to get burnt out, so please stay tuned to Animal Voices. Quickly plug the Animal Voices website, which is animalvoices.ca. We have almost all of our archive programs on that site. There's about 128 programs that we have up there now, so check it out. This interview will also be archived within the next week or so, and I'll give you our email too. We're always looking for comments and suggestions and ideas for upcoming shows or feedback about our current programs. You can write us at animalvoices@ciut.fm. I also wanted to give some information, and I'll give this again at the end of the program, about people, I guess for our listeners in Toronto who are interested in getting involved with Food Not Bombs. I wasn't able to connect with the Toronto chapter, but hopefully we will get them on the program at some point soon. But here's here's some information about people who want to get involved and go out to one of the Food Not Bombs servings. The servings are Sundays at 1 p.m. at Nathan Phillips Square, and that's Queen West and Bay. And the meetings are Thursdays at 7 p.m. at Uprising Books, and that's at 168 Baldwin Street. So we will, like I said, we'll announce that information again at the end of the program. But now we turn to our feature guest for today. I'm really excited to speak with Keith McHenry, who is one of the co-founders of the original Food Not Bombs, which was started in 1980. It's a real pleasure to have you on. It's a real honor. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Great. Thanks for having me. That's fantastic.
So you're actually, I was looking at some of the information about you, and there's a hell of a lot about you on the internet. And you did community radio for a long time.
Yeah, I helped co-found San Francisco Liberation Radio. And I actually, from a jail cell in Oakland, talked to Stephen Dunifer, who started Free Radio Berkeley, and that we kind of together worked on plans to start that. And when I did this from a high-rise jail in downtown Oakland.
I'd love to talk more about that at some point during the interview. When I was trying to figure out, you know, what our focus could be, I was looking at some of the bibliographic information about you and some of the history of Food Not Bombs. I really felt quite overwhelmed. It's difficult to try to distill something down to, you know, 45 minutes of conversation. But I have kind of a dual purpose for the interview. One is I definitely want to give a great introduction to Food Not Bombs for people who maybe don't know anything about it. I had read a little bit about the movement at the beginning of the program, but I feel like it doesn't really capture the flavor of it without hearing directly from somebody who's been involved. And then the other focus, I would really like to talk about your history as an activist. And because we have so many people listening who are currently activists, maybe you can share some wisdom with us about how you got involved and how you keep going.
Okay, well, it really started in the Vietnam War. Even though I was a kid, I was like in the eighth grade or so, I was given a copy of Walden by Henry David Thoreau. And being the kid, I read the back part first, which was the speech that he gave about why he spent the night in jail, refusing to pay war taxes. And that made a big impression on me. So I really started quite young. I think I was in the fifth or sixth grade. And seeing the Vietnam War on TV, that's like something different than what we experience now, where the war is not really shown in the media. It just horrified me. And so I basically started, I spent from that time on organizing. And there were other big influences that happened. When I was older and I was in college, I happened to come across Helen Caldicott, the anti-nuclear activist, speaking in the Boston Commons in Boston, Massachusetts, about what was going on with the threat of nuclear war. And it was a funny little thing where she was on a milk crate, and there was about 10 or 15 grandmothers sitting around watching her tell this horrific story, and I was like the only, apparently probably the only one that wasn't from Women's International League and Peace and Freedom that was sitting there. And I decided at that moment that I should dedicate myself to trying to stop the whole issue of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And that brought me into contact with many activists that were trying to shut down Seabrook Nuclear Power Plant, which is the last nuclear power plant to be put online in the United States. And I participated in those protests up in New Hampshire. And it was out of my affinity. Well, that's when I learned about affinity groups and making decisions by consensus and kind of the whole way of organizing. And I was very, very involved in putting up flyers and posters all over town. And I did, our affinity group did these things where we would go out and we would lay on the ground on the sidewalks and trace ourselves with chalk and then use spray paint to make it look like there was all these dead bodies throughout plazas and stuff, and then we'd spray paint anti-war information all over. And the war in El Salvador was happening at that time, too. So we were trying to educate Americans about the fact that they were doing this brutal war. That's kind of surprising. Even to this day, most Americans have no idea that they were involved in a conflict that killed over 80,000 civilians. But, you know, that's America for you. So it's really, you know, I felt like we need to speak to regular Americans about what their government is doing in their behalf and to try to reach them in any way possible. And it was through that that we came up with the idea of doing Food Not Bombs.
Mm-hmm.
And then the first thing that we did, we had these huge direct actions where we were trying to take over the construction site where the nuclear power plant was being built. And we did a series of two of them. And then at the end of the second one, we decided, well, everybody in New Hampshire is pretty aware of what's going on with this nuclear power plant. But the largest city, Boston, the people there really don't have a clue. And we decided that we did research and found out that the board of directors of the First National Bank of Boston were also the board of directors of the company that was building the nuclear power plant, and they were also the board of directors of the company buying it. And so they were basically doing the same scam that led to the Great Depression, you know, lending themselves money without any oversight.
Mm.
And we wanted to have a soup kitchen out in front of the stockholders meeting of the First National Bank of Boston and kind of make that point. We have literature we designed that showed that links between the bank's board of directors and the board of directors of the public service company in New Hampshire. And we, the night before, we were getting worried that we wouldn't have enough people to come and have it look like a soup line. And it occurred to us, well, there's actually really hungry people in Boston who would need this food. Why don't we go talk to them? And we went to the Pine Street Inn, and it was mostly Vietnam vets that were living in this shelter. And they were, like, really excited because they hadn't been to a protest in years since the 60s and everything. And they joined us, and it was, like, this really amazing experience where we were talking to people going into the stockholders meeting. Business people were coming by from the subway. And homeless, mostly homeless men, but some women, too, were hanging out with us eating. And we ended up in these really lively conversations, so we decided, that's exactly what we should do to organize. And it was that evening we went home, washed all our pots and pans and everything, and decided that we would do this on a daily basis, basically. And the eight of us went and we got a house together that we rented, and we quit our jobs, and we made arrangements to pick up produce that wasn't that couldn't be sold from, like, at that time I worked at a natural food store, and I knew we threw away all this produce every day. And we figured out a way to get tofu from a tofu factory, and we had all these baked goods. And then we just started doing two different things, basically. One, we'd set up a table in the town square and talk to people, like, 4 days a week. And we would have hot cider and stuff to encourage them to stop and join us. And then we would deliver food to all the housing projects and daycare centers and places like that. And then we'd also provide hot meals at protests so that people would stay at the demonstrations longer. We would get more people to attend the protests. And so that's how Boston Food Not Bombs started. And that was for 8 years, that was the only chapter.
Mm. So
and then, then I moved to San Francisco in 88. And that's when the second group started. And that was, like, really heavy experience because in Boston, we were actually friends with the local government. And we even had a refrigerator at City Hall. But in San Francisco, to our surprise, they ended up arresting us and starting a brutal campaign against Food Not Bombs.
Okay, so tell us more about that. Why? What were the differences then, and how were you perceived that it was such a threat?
It's kind of a funny thing, because in America, people assume that San Francisco is this liberal city. And, of course, I assumed that, even though, and I've been there on and off my whole life. But it turned out that the mayor who just came to power when we started, started feeling pressure from the business community to get rid of the homeless. And their basic theory was, and this was happening even in Boston before I left Boston, the same idea was starting to happen nationwide, which is the Justice Department, the federal government, had come up with this idea that the presence of homeless people were hurting the U.S. economy. And they were able to convince the mayor, Art Agnos, in San Francisco, that he had to drive the homeless from the city or the economy of San Francisco would start to fail. And we really didn't see that coming, and we were just serving free food in Golden Gate Park every Monday. And then one day, police came and harassed us and yelled at us and stuff. But we thought, well, that's just a bizarre thing. You know, we don't know why that's happening. And then the next Monday, 45 riot police came out of the woods and arrested 9 of us for serving food. And we put the word out that the cops had harassed us the week before. So a lot of neighborhood activists came, as well as the people we were feeding. And there was a newspaper reporter from the San Francisco Chronicle that also came. And it ended up in the news. And the next week we had a march down the street, Hate Street. And like several hundred people joined us, and we carried all of our food and everything and banged pots and pans and marched down Hate and set up our table and start serving again, and then 27 people were arrested. And then the next week, we had an even larger protest, and the government said, oh, and this becomes typical in the, over the years, this happens frequently now with different governments trying to drive us away. They would say, oh, well, we'll give you this armory out by the ocean, and you can feed people inside this armory. But to us, we were like, well, our idea is to try to change society so that there aren't homeless and hungry people, and we're not interested in being another soup kitchen like all of the other churches and stuff in town. We're about talking to the general public about the ideas of our priorities being misdirected towards war instead of going towards human needs. And so we really wouldn't be able to do any outreach to the public in nearly as an effective way if we were in this armory and where no one would see us. And it was also clear the government would probably shut that down after a few weeks anyway. And that's what it turned out. We had 100 arrests that year. Then the mayor, being embarrassed by all the world's attention on the city, gave us a permit to serve food. And then the next year, when they decided to get rid of the homeless again, and they started this brutal campaign of bringing fire trucks to areas where there are homeless people and then hosing them down in the middle of the night, and they would like beat up homeless people and jail them and things like that, the people living on the street started talking to us saying, you know, we really need your support because we're under this heavy attack. And so we decided to move on after the third day of talking to people on the streets. And because of the arrest, we had so many more volunteers that we could serve 3 days a week. We decided to move in front of City Hall, like a block away from where we were originally serving food at UN Plaza, and set up a camp with all the homeless people who had started to move into the front of City Hall as a way of trying to get some protection from these beatings that were happening in other parks and stuff. And we had a tent city of about maybe at the height. We had 500 homeless people were living there, and we served free vegetarian food like 24 hours a day. And that lasted 27 days until they opened a shelter about a block away, this old used car dealership. And then they made an announcement that the good homeless people would live in the shelter, and anyone that wasn't in there was considered a criminal. And they then sent riot police, like hundreds of riot police, into the park and drove us out. And then they decided, the government made a law saying that it was illegal to give away free food outside in City Park. And they had a court order against us. And that kind of set the stage for the next maybe almost 10 years, and during that time, there would be these periods in the summer where they would arrest us every day, and by 1997, there was over 1,000 arrests, many beatings. A number of us were tortured what they would do is rip our ligaments and tendons. They'd lift us by our arms and legs while we're face down on the floor of the police station, and then after they rip our legs and all of our tendons, they'd put us like in a little box that they called K-cell, and you'd stay there all scrunched up for like 3 or 4 days where you couldn't stretch your legs out, and to maximize pain and to try to freak us out into stopping. But we never did stop, and in fact, the more that this happened, the more other other chapters started. And so they were like Food Not Bombs chapters started up all over the world, really. The first one outside of the U.S. was in Vancouver, B.C. Then, you know, after a while, it was in most of the major cities of Canada, all the largest cities of the United States, and it was started, the first group in Europe started in what was then Czechoslovakia, in Prague, and there was a group started in Melbourne, Australia, and it just started to take off. And even though the arrest stopped in San Francisco in 97, Food Not Bombs just continued to grow and grow and grow. And now it's on every continent except for Antarctica. And I'm just always amazed at how much it grows. And one of the other things, you were talking about the radio movement. We started that because at one point in San Francisco during these arrests, the mainstream media stopped reporting at all because it was a daily, so it wasn't interesting. So we ended up deciding to start our own radio stations. And since it was illegal to serve free food, then why was, you know, restrictions on the airwaves? That didn't make sense, too, that we needed to get permits for that. So we were able to start radio stations in roughly 400 cities in the United States through the height of encouraging the creation of pirate radio stations.
Well, that's a great introduction to the history. I'm curious about just jumping back for a moment before we talk about some of the different activism that you've been involved with and more about Food Not Bombs. But I wanted to pick up on something that you had said about when this first started, about how you quit your jobs. You said that there were, you know, I think this, you said there were 8 of you. So, right. You know, we got involved and we quit our jobs and we did this. Can you tell us about the logistics of doing something like that?
Well, it turned out to be more difficult than we thought. Part of our idea was we had food screening equipment and stuff, and we made T-shirts, which we tried to sell, and we had Food Not Bombs buttons that we tried to sell at our table in Harvard Square and in the Boston Commons. And we had some idea that somehow we could raise enough money for our rent. But after not paying our rent for 6 months, eventually the landlady had a meeting with us, and we assumed we'd be kicked out. And what she said, well, you know, I'm hearing about all this great work you're doing in the city. And she's a very wealthy, you know, like kind of one of the wealthiest people in Cambridge. And in the grapevine, she'd heard that we were providing all this food. So she said, well, you know, you don't have to pay for the 6 months you haven't paid for, and clearly the amount I'm charging you is too much, so we'll reduce it by several hundred dollars if you start paying the rent next month. And as a result of that, we ended up having to take part-time job. And so what I would do, for instance, is I was a cook in Passim's Cafe, which was a folk music venue in Harvard Square, and I'd do that at night, and then I'd do Food Not Bombs in the day. And I must say that that's essentially what's happened ever since. For the whole 25 years I've been doing Food Not Bombs, I hold a part-time job at the same time as I do volunteer for Food Not Bombs, basically full-time. Hmm. And one of the reasons we eventually decided to not have any paid staff in Food Not Bombs was because, you know, obviously homeless people, they definitely need jobs and they need income. You know, everybody kind of does. You know, that's important for everybody to be able to make a living. And we didn't want there to be a hierarchy between the staff, people who were paid Food Not Bombs activists, and the people that we were working with on the street. And so we just have made it a policy that we're all volunteer and that we have no one is getting paid to do Food Not Bombs. So that's had its ups and downs, and it's meant that I've been homeless quite a number of times, actually, through the whole 25 years I've done Food Not Bombs. But, you know, still, I think that the idea of not, you know, you see so many other activist groups will have a paid staff, and there becomes this very intense hierarchy of the paid staff versus the volunteers, then the groups don't tend to flourish nearly as well as Food Not Bonds does. And I think that's one of the secrets to why it's global, besides being, you know, like an easy enough idea to figure out how to do. You know, you go out and collect food, and you cook it, and you hand it out on the street, and you make flyers and literature about peace and social justice issues, and you connect yourself with other social movements. You know, we're like, you know, all over the world, we will provide food to encampments and things like that. So there'll be, you know, like the redwood trees in California, we would set up a base camp and have food for the people sitting in the trees and stuff. And in Australia, we organized a base camp outside of a refugee detention center and fed protesters there for months. And in fact, we even like cut a hole into the through the fence and freed a whole lot of refugees and took them home with us in Australia. And then we do, you know, like in Palestine, we serve food to the people waiting at the checkpoints coming into work in Israel. And we have like base camps to protest when the border between Poland and Germany was so severe. You know, we'd help people on that border. And then we provide food at you know, other, you know, like anti-globalization demonstrations and make it possible for people to actually focus on whatever their resistance is to capitalism and know that they'll get a good, healthy meal through the entire action. You know, feel confident that they don't have to leave to go forage for food or something like that. We've also been very involved in, like, the sovereignty movements throughout the world where we'll, like in the U.S., particularly the Native American resistance to what the government's doing to them, we provide food at their actions and so on, as well as take food to housing projects and daycare centers and so on in the urban areas and serve free food on the streets.
Hmm. You've been described as the gentle anarchist, which I thought was a really lovely description. I don't know how accurate you feel that it is. I don't know if you describe yourself as an anarchist, but I think for me, I've been in a position where I've been teaching students for a number of years now at university as a teaching assistant, and sometimes we'll have these really heated political debates about different types of structures, different types of possibilities for organizing for change, and often people will say things like, you know, if, you know, well, if we don't have hierarchies, if there's no leader per se, then nothing gets done and it can't work. And I think that Food Not Bombs really kind of throws a wedge into that kind of thinking. People sometimes think that consensus building means that nothing really ever gets achieved.
Yeah, well, ever since I read Thoreau's On Civil Disobedience, I have been an anarchist. I started reading literature about anarchism from that time on. You know, anarchism is not chaos the way the mainstream media describes anarchism as somehow being chaos or somehow being about violence and destruction. And it's, really, it's a anarchism is about actually being very organized and having everybody have an equal say. It's the most highly democratic form of political organizing that that so far we've thought of. And anarchists don't necessarily have to be disorganized either. And there's a very clear process on making decisions as anarchists, which is called consensus. And our collective, Food Not Bombs, actually, we wrote a book called On Conflict and Consensus, and it's like it's a Robert's Rules of Order kind of a manual. It's a very simple, like 60-page manual on how to make decisions where every single person in the group has an equal say to the outcome of the decision. And when people follow these guidelines, organizations tend to really flourish. And I think that that's been one of the reasons, for instance, that Food Not Bombs could be so brutally attacked, where the city of San Francisco claims it spent $50 million trying to stop us. But we, because of our dedication to using consensus at each of our weekly meetings and having a non-hierarchical structure, they couldn't stop us. And even the San Francisco Police Intelligence Department at one time captured me and brought me to their headquarters, and they were freaked out. They didn't know how we were continuing to resist in such a way, but not resorting to violence, and that they couldn't break our spirit. And, you know, it's right in the Food Not Bombs book as to how we did that, and I pointed that out to them. You know, they could read the book themselves.
Right.
And they still, in the end, they had to stop. They just couldn't outlast us. So, you know, nonviolent civil resistance. And, you know, Gandhi actually, you know, thought of himself as an anarchist. And he has writing, you know, he writes about anarchism, and he declared himself an anarchist. A lot of people are not aware of that fact. He was very influenced by Henry David Thoreau as well. And the whole idea of civil resistance and anarchism and nonviolent civil resistance is something that has a very long historic root. And I think that particularly in what's happening now, that for instance, I just recently spoke in Lagos, Nigeria on Gandhi's birthday, and Gandhi's really, you know, plays a big part in the history of Africa because of his work in South Africa. And at the end, these young people from college came up and spoke to me. And two things that they thought were so important, and this is why they want to start Food Not Bombs throughout all of Africa, is our idea of there being of nonviolent resistance, because in Nigeria, violence is epidemic. They see violence all day, every day. There's brutal murders and killings and, you know, in neighborhoods throughout their city of Lagos. And the other thing that they thought was really important was the having no hierarchy. They thought the whole idea of working by consensus collectively was really significant. And the two things of focusing on nonviolence and on consensus would potentially turn their country, if not their continent, around. And they're very, very enthusiastic about that. And on foodnotbombs.net, there's actually, you can read their statement that they wrote in support of starting the Food Not Bombs movement through Nigeria. And being peaceful you know, there's so much violence already in the world. And really, like, if you read the words of the opponents of Gandhi, for instance, the thing that was most frustrating was the fact that the resistance would never be violent. And if the people would become violent, if they could get Gandhi's people to resist in a armed way, then they would have the solution. They could then just wipe them out and kill them. And sure, they could kill nonviolent activists as well. But the reality is that there is not popular support for doing that, and that most people really don't want a violent future in a violent world. And you can really build a much stronger, larger movement of resistance if you maintain your nonviolent position. And I think that debate right now, particularly in the United States and also in Canada, is really, really important, because the authorities do want us to be violent. We're already having a lot of Food Not Bombs activists that are being arrested on terrorist charges in the United States. I just lost a friend of mine, Bill Rogers, who was found dead in his cell in Flagstaff, Arizona, who was, amongst other things, a Food Not Bombs volunteer. And the government here is claiming that we're terrorists. And Food Not Bombs is considered one of the most hardcore terrorist groups in the United States. According to the New York Times, they published an article claiming that listing me as one of the 100 most dangerous Americans. And we just recently, with MSNBC, did a report, and they published Pentagon documents showing that actions that I helped organize were considered a terrorist threat. And so we already have that happening full tilt. And so if we were to react violently, it would give great cause to the authorities to round us all up. They would be able to easily justify their repression. But because of our nonviolence position, we've actually become much more strong. It's much more difficult for the authorities to clamp down on us. and we are able to build a lot more sympathy and support amongst the general population. And this is clearly, according to the internal memos I've gotten in different lawsuits and stuff, something that is very, very frustrating. And they really wish that we would start to burn down buildings and attack politicians and stuff, because then they would be able to really erase our movement. But because we don't do that, they're struggling. They're not able to shut us down, and we're growing just by leaps and bounds. It's this strategy of nonviolent direct action and civil resistance is really, really, in my way of seeing, the most effective way to turn around such a horrible direction that our society is going in.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, about the political context. If you feel, looking back, beginning with doing anti-Vietnam War stuff and seeing now with the rise on the so-called war on terror, if you think that the political climate for activists to be able to do positive work has really changed and made it more difficult for activists, or is this sort of the same game with a different face?
Well, I think that between the COINTELPRO operations of the Vietnam War era and now, in some ways it's much more difficult, but then in other ways it's much easier. For instance, we do have like websites and internet and so on still, which is a positive thing, and I'm not sure why that hasn't been shut down yet, but that's still happening. And the movement today in the United States, the resistance to the authorities is very, very sophisticated overall and very big. And I think a lot of people nowadays don't feel that, they think of the 60s as being a very, very large protest, which there were. But in reality, I think it's more, we have much deeper understanding of what's going on, and people they can't just stop the war in Iraq and have the anti-war movement disappear in the way that they did with Vietnam. And so there's things that are very, very good, but there's also big problems, because while the technology is useful for us, the websites and internet, their ability to surveil, just as something that they could only dream of back in the 60s. And the other thing is that their control of media is even worse now than it was in the 60s. So that's another whole issue that in the United States, it's really impossible to get the word out. Essentially, there's no mainstream information about there being even a protest movement of any kind, as far as National Public Radio or Fox TV or any of the commercial stations. And even the community radio stations here in Tucson, for instance, we have this situation where we have one public affairs program called Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and that's from 3 to 4, Monday through Friday. And then the other block of progressive information is on Sundays from 3:30 to 4:30. And efforts in the community to get these important programs put at a time when everyone can listen to them have failed, and it's pretty certain what's gone on is there's been a systematic placing of Justice Department officials, FBI people, into the management positions of all the community radio stations in the United States, because this is a pattern that is very, very widespread. And we know they did that with Pacifica's stations back in the 90s, and fortunately we successfully threw out these Justice Department employees and took back those five stations. But that's really only five stations out of a whole huge country. And so the other thing is that a lot of people are not, what's fascinating, when I was speaking on our community radio station the other day about domestic surveillance, I'm often smeared. They have very organized smear campaigns against people like myself down here. And they will say, that I'm paranoid about surveillance and paranoid, I'm just making all this stuff up. This stuff doesn't happen. And, of course, now we see that even the mainstream media has pointed out that the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and the Pentagon and so on, and the NSA, National Security Agency, are spying on Americans. And so in some senses we're vindicated, and it's helping a little bit, but it also is still something to overcome. And that's why back again to nonviolent and consensus. We, early on in Sudan bombs, were under surveillance, infiltrated, and had problems. And apparently, I guess the authorities felt that our idea was really good, and they needed to stop it. Well, by organizing using consensus, that actually made it very, very hard for the police to, the FBI, to undermine our organization. And in other groups that I was in at that time, what would happen is that if there became key decisions to be made, the FBI would just send so many people to the meeting that they would outvote the actual activists attending the meeting.
Wow.
And that happened so frequently in the late 70s, early 80s, that that's one of the other reasons we became dedicated to making decisions by consensus, because it, while it's not impossible for them to infiltrate and cause problems, it makes it a lot more difficult for them to actually succeed at stopping our ability to organize.
Hmm. I know that people listening who maybe are new to Food Not Bombs, who are regular listeners of Animal Voices, might be thinking, this is all very interesting, but why would you have him on an Animal Voices program? And, I mean, I see lots of connections here, but I was wondering if you could pull some out for us. I know that... I mean, for me, the animal movements, a lot of them, different segments anyway, have been pushing for a long time a non-violent agenda. And Food Not Bombs has also been serving vegetarian food right from the beginning. And during our phone call conversation a few days ago, we were talking about how Food Not Bombs was inspired by books like Diet for a Small Planet. Could you talk about why vegetarian food with Food Not Bombs? I know there's a couple of different reasons why.
Yeah, there are actually, one of the things early on when we were starting Food Not Bombs is we wanted to show by our way of living and every aspect of Food Not Bombs our political point of view. And since we were for peace and nonviolent, we couldn't really get behind the idea of violence against animals. And actually, if you read in our On Conflict and Consensus and in the Food Not Bombs book, we actually, there's some of the people in there are not people, but they're actually our dogs, although we give them as much credit as for what happened as the people. So we wanted to show that animals should have the same rights as humans, that we wanted to show that we were nonviolent. We also wanted to... being unhealthy towards your own self is a form of violence. And we also wanted to show that to save the environment, we need to change our way of eating. Because so much land is destroyed by factory farming, by the beef and pig and chicken industry. Rivers and streams are horribly polluted. And just the whole promotion violence in the society, the whole, really, even if you're not the actual person slaughtering the animals, the kind of whole energy of dominating other species, brutally killing them by the thousands, and then thinking that somehow this is a healthy way to be organizing society and to be eating, were all issues we wanted to address. Also, we actually, before people were writing about veganism, our recipes in the Food Not Bombs book and the food that we generally gave out was vegan, even though we really didn't think of it in that way at the beginning. So just the exploitation of animals, and we thought, well, that's not right to be exploiting animals when we're also organizing to end the exploitation of people. And then the other issue that is really important is that you can safely recover vegetarian food and give it out without worrying about poisoning people. Even if you agree with the idea of eating meat, it's much, much safer to be giving away vegetarian food. The need for refrigeration and steam tables, all of those issues vanish as a result of focusing on the vegetarian diet. So it makes it so that people without any resources at all, with very, very little money, any person basically, can organize a Food Not Bombs group, and they don't need to buy refrigerators and trucks necessarily or steam tables to be able to do it. And so as all of those issues were linked. And, you know, just to have a peaceful, nonviolent future, you know, we wanted every aspect of what we were doing to reflect that the ideology of peace and good health and being positive. And I think that we were in 1980, many people weren't vegetarian or had not experienced any vegetarian food. And by stopping at the Food Not Bombs table and eating with us, they were able to discover that, sure enough, you could live on a vegetarian diet, and the food was tasty, and it was a really positive thing.
Keith, I'm just going to interrupt you there for a minute. I wanted to make sure that Lamia, who is our tech and also, I guess, sort of a part-time co-host as well on the show, gets to ask a question.
Okay, great.
I wanted to ask you, Keith, what do you do for yourself to keep yourself healthy? Or what do you, I mean, obviously some of the things you mentioned would keep you healthy, like good intentions and good food, etc. But to be able to be involved with Food Not Bombs and social justice for over 2 decades since you were in sixth grade, what do you do for yourself?
Well, my big thing is I'm very into this thing called aqua aerobics. So I'm a member of the YMCA. So I do the swimming and the kind of exercise in the water, the slow impact. But I do have very serious health challenges in that I have, from these beatings and so on, I've ended up with fibromyalgia. So I struggle with that all the time. And so I am always working on having my diet be fine-tuned so that I don't have things like wheat or things like that might inflame my nervous system. And one of the reasons I live in Tucson is because the hiking and everything here is really fantastic. And I ride my mountain bike, which I love. And so there's those kinds of things. But I do think also, like you were implying, that being excited about what I'm doing, that really makes it possible to maintain good health. It's just so rewarding doing Food Not Bombs, and it's a testament of, you know, you feel like you're really having an impact on the future. And I think that plays both that's an important emotionally and physically.
Over the years, have you had a kind of consistent personal health focus? Something that's come in the last few years? Or?
Well, I started doing aquarobics and really paying attention to my health maybe about 15 years ago. And before that, I wasn't really so focused on that. And I had a job throughout the whole time in San Francisco, which was very good. As I put up posters in store windows, so I walked miles and miles every day, and that was really good. But I wasn't really thinking of it as being part of good health. I was just doing it. And so it wasn't until I had a series of operations for being smashed in the face by the police of the Billy Club that I started really focusing on taking care of myself. And occasionally I would do fasts, you know, cleansing fasts and stuff like that. That's a little harder now with the fibromyalgia. I've been a vegetarian since I was in high school, in my second year of high school. So that's also, I think, played an important part. You know.
I mean, psychologically, too, your activism, when you talked before, you talked about, you know, that it has, I guess, compromised some of the relationships that you've had, that you've also had consistent personal surveillance, you know, in addition to the physical attacks that you've experienced. There's been a psychological war on you as well during the years.
Yeah, there's been like some really intense experiences surrounding that. went out on the street. She's still an activist. But the whole, you know, knowing that you're being listened to every, you know, all the time in your house, you know, knowing that they profile you and they have people that try to pit you against one another, that kind of thing. And many of the events that would happen outside turn out to be manipulated by the police. And so it's very, very stressful. And in the end, that kind of thing broke up the relationship. And they did things like they hustled my, like when I was facing life in prison, they had a FBI person dressed in a nice coat and tie and everything and stand next to my wife at the bus station and bus stop and go home with her every night and so on and then start to romancing her, you know, and just saying, well, it's too bad, you'll never get out of prison, you know, why don't we start seeing each other, that kind of stuff. You know, it's very, very difficult, very stressful, and for any of my partners, you know, wondering whether I'm coming home tonight, or, you know, even if I'm like a few minutes late calling, saying I'm still on my way, the anxiety can be really great.
Keith, we're out of time. I'm so sorry.
No, okay.
But I wanted to, it's a somber note to end on, but I mean, one of the things that strikes me about looking through the writings that you've done, the activism that you've been involved with, and some of the art that you've done, too, that people should do a search for you on the internet and see that see some of the other work that you've been involved with, because as I said at the beginning of the program, you know, you've been through all this, but you still persevere. There's some lovely pictures of cactuses online and that type of thing that you've been involved with, too, that I would really encourage people to check out it as well. A very full artistic life and a very full, you know, mental life that you've had in addition to all this activism that you've done. I want to say, I know that this is sort of cheesy always to say, but really you are an inspiration, and I thank you so much for the work that you've done and for continuing to speak out and inspire so many activists today and continue on with your own work. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Well, thank you so much. Well, it is very exciting, and I definitely encourage anyone to have a life of activism, because it's certainly, you know, I found it wonderful, no matter how difficult it is. It's certainly a great way to live. And sure, you know, I'm not rich and all that, but it's I'm rich in experiences, and you certainly have a great deal of pride as a result of standing up for what you believe.
Wonderful. Well, I wanted to thank you again and quickly just give the information for Food Not Bombs in Toronto. The servings are Sundays at 1 p.m. at Nathan Phillips Square, and the meetings are Thursday at 7 p.m. at Uprising Books.
I just wanted to say also, Keith, thank you very much. You have today reinforced yet again my belief that one, as in one of many, can make a huge, huge, huge impact on the planet.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then if you go to foodnotbombs.net, you can travel around in that little website, and it will turn you on to all kinds of different aspects of animal rights and Food Not Bombs type things.
And best of luck with your trip to Africa.
Great.
I know that
you
you're
so
going
much.
and going to be talking with them about Food Not Bombs there. Thanks again, Keith McHenry, one of the co-founders of Food Not Bombs. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5. My apologies to Sarah. We've gone a little bit over time, but please do stay tuned for Roadrunner.